Network. This is Kathy Arroy, I'm your host, and we're at Roberta's Pizza. Thanks so much to TechSir for bringing you this wonderful show and this wonderful station. So today we're here with a special guest, two of them actually. We have Michelle Maisto, who's the author of a new memoir called The Gastronomy of Marriage by Random House. Just came out. Hey, how's it going?
Great.
Thanks so much for coming.
Oh, my pleasure.
So Michelle's book is all about food, love, and marriage. And unfortunately, your husband, Rich, couldn't make it today.
No.
He's working.
I think he's...
he could be somewhere. Anywhere. So instead, I brought on one of my good friends, Matt.
Hello,
Bogdanov.
Everybody.
Hey.
Hi.
He's one of my favorite dating coaches, personally. but you're also quite a foodie, too. So
indeed.
Home cook extraordinaire. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to, you know, talk about Michelle's book, of course, because this is your first book.
Yeah. So it just came out in September, and it's my first book.
And why did you choose to talk about food? First of all, I love the cover. If you guys want to check out, like, the cover, it's these summer squashes that are kind of entwined, like they're in this loving embrace.
Yeah, little swan squash. No, they did a really good job with the cover.
Nice. So,
I think food has just always been a topic for me. It's always been the most natural thing to write about. I come from a family where that's all we talk about. You know, you're washing the dishes from lunch and you're talking about what to make from dinner. It's food is always the topic. So I think that was very natural. And then it was a really natural way to talk about just being in an interracial relationship where food was really one of the biggest maybe things that were different between us, but we both really related to it. Food was a big part of both of our families. So in wanting to talk about issues of identity and marriage and the interracial thing, food was just a really natural thread through all these things.
So food just ties into everything kind of in life and family, relationships.
Totally.
That's great. I can definitely relate, especially with growing up with a food-obsessed family. I think you said somewhere in the book that every holiday was based around food or family
getting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There are the special things to make for each holiday and even the ways that we go about celebrating it, and maybe one holiday has its special breads and one has its cookies, but yeah, food was a big part of it.
Interesting. Special breads, that's something I haven't explored.
And I think I didn't even realize until Rich and I got engaged and moved in together how much our identities were entwined in the foods of our families. But
very different foods of your families, too.
Exactly.
So there's a whole other... that's fun.
So when we were dating, food was this, a big part of our courtship and a big way that we got along. We, you know, both really enjoy eating. But I think once we moved in together, and in your home, you want to be comfortable and you want it to be you. And so suddenly in this area where we had so much in common, that it was a lot of friction because I think we were both sort of setting a stake in the ground for our own identity and our own ways of doing things.
Maybe you're both like kind of the alpha cooks and you're like, what
I'm afraid that was... Yeah. Exactly.
Interesting. But eventually you got to work together in the kitchen.
Yeah. I think we came to some compromises and sort of figuring out the things we could eat together because I didn't eat meat, but he did. And, you know...
Oh, that's a big thing. Yeah.
Digest a roofing shingle, but, you know, too much tomato sauce gave him a stomach ache, things like that. And just even his metabolism is crazy. He can eat a box of donuts for breakfast and be fine. But, you know, pasta every night sort of... I'd pack on the pound. So, you know, there's just this, like, dance we were doing through everything, trying to figure out what to eat.
I think this is really neat because a lot of people equate relationships with a lot of dining out experiences.
Yeah.
Whereas yours, this sounds like it's totally cooking related.
Well, that was maybe not part of the problem, because, you know, when you're dating, you do go out a lot. And then when we'd host each other in our own apartments, maybe you're more accommodating and like, I don't care, make whatever, or, oh, that sounds good. Or you make something you know the other person likes. But then when you're at home, all that sort of goes out the window and you sort of want what you want, I think. Maybe that's what
it is. It's like you're stepping into someone's territory.
Yeah.
This is the way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's part of hospitality, I guess. You gotta... it's somebody's kitchen at first, not both, so.
But so when you start a new apartment together, maybe it's just finding, you know, figuring out. It's a territorial thing for sure.
Sure. I remember that in roommate situations. Did you ever have lots of roommates and you have to share a kitchen? Matt, I know you have like three roommates.
Yeah.
Is there a cooking boss of the apartment and generally? Well, I mean,
luckily, two of the four people in the apartment, including myself, two of them don't cook at all. They'll bring home takeout every once in a while.
I think that this is pretty normal, typical in
and,
New York, especially.
And me and the other roommate, we've lived in the apartment both for 5 and 6 years, respectively. We have a really sort of sweet relationship at times. Just this morning, I was like, oh, hey, Ryan, we need a new egg frying pan. Like, what should we get? Stainless steel? Should we get cast iron?
Oh, so, you guys split a...
Yeah, we split the cost of all of our cookware because we're the only two people who cook in the apartment. And at times it does kind of seem like we're in some sort of marriage.
Do you clean equally? Are you both good at cleaning up?
Very good.
Because that's a big deal.
Yeah, no, and especially because there's four people in a very small apartment with a very small kitchen. You sort of have to wash your pots and pans after you cook because otherwise the next person who comes, invariably like 10 minutes later, he wants to cook dinner. We'll have to deal with it. So it's just a courtesy thing. And since he and I are the only ones who actually cook, it works out pretty well.
Actually, that's an interesting topic. Who cleans up after what? Because I feel like even though if you cook a nice meal, say it's your apartment, if the other person doesn't rise to the challenge and say, can I help? Can I clean up? That's totally, I don't know.
Yeah, we
even though it's my sink, you know, I want you to clean up because I just cooked. Do you ever get that?
Just this morning, actually, me and my lady friend were making huevos rancheros, which is a good standby for us. And it's my kitchen, and I usually do the cooking, and I usually love it. But this morning, I was a little hungover and not in the mood. So I was just like, ugh, you have to make it this morning. And she's so great, and she would have. She's the kind of person that will cook the food, and then as soon as the other person starts trying to wash the dishes, she'll get kind of upset.
Oh.
To be like, no, let me do it, let me do it, I'll do it. It's, I mean, that's just, I think it's a little too much courtesy, but, and so I just do it without even saying anything.
Good man. No, we definitely, whoever does the cooking, the other person does the cleaning up. For me, even if I'm the person who winds up more often than doing the cooking, I don't feel like, you know, the slave in the relationship or something. It feels definitely more balanced.
Yeah. So it's funny, we were talking about like morning after meals and breakfast meals with like a date on a couple shows ago, and huevos rancheros. How do you cook that? That sounds like a kind of perfect morning.
Such a good hangover treat. Well, and I also had a bunch of tortillas left over, so it just made sense. The funny thing.
So it's tortillas, beans.
Million. Do you remember David and Shayna and their obsession with it? And they had a whole wall of like every single huevos rancheros they ever ate in New York City. That's adorable. That is.
Why eat out huevos rancheros when you can throw together
so
old
to
tortillas,
home,
leftover chips from the night before,
and some eggs? That sounds pretty cheap.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What else is in there? Chilies? What are you doing?
Well,
with this?
That's what I'm wondering.
What we do is we do, you know, we cook garlic and onions down with the in a pan, olive oil, and then we add beans and jalapenos. So you make sort of not a refried beans, but a black bean dish. That's one component, and then just some fresh tomato salsa with cilantro, lime juice. More pepper, you know, more jalapeno.
Sounds like a good wake up dish.
Oh, it is so good. And then good cheddar cheese. You could do like queso blanco or something like that to make it really authentic.
Okay.
Could you poach the eggs in sort of that like simmering tomato-y thing?
Yeah, you know, that's what do they call that?
Chilaquiles?
Yeah.
Or corn huevo. Well...
I was actually on the way to from the grocery store. If I would have done it, Lisa was the one who helmed the frying pan this morning. If I would have done it, I was thinking poached.
Would have been
amazing.
Yeah. I tend to think that really messy food, like a splattering plate of, you know, runny eggs is something really fun to eat with a person.
Yeah, they have to be sunny side up. So you know, the yolk drips all over.
Yeah.
The
scoop it all up.
The tortilla. Yeah.
For a long time, I was a very separate... I didn't like my yellow and white separate. I had to have scrambled or something, but I've come around, and it's a very good world to be in, this like dippy egg yolk yumminess.
And isn't that kind of like marriage?
Is that,
the unity of the yolk and
who
the helps? White.
Very
is,
nice.
Is Rich, did he participate in like converting you over there? Or to the
No, I felt like I could
territory?
See how much people were enjoying it, and it was one of these things where I could see it was a good thing, and I just had to sort of like force myself to eat it enough times and then come around. Calvin Trillin, in The Man Who Ate Everything, Jeffrey Steingarten,
yes,
writes how if you eat something 8 to 10 times, you know, our food aversions right. can be overcome. So I just kept eating it like, I know this must be good. Like,
right. Your palate just fat. Can keep evolving forever.
Yeah, I think it was a weird little kid thing I had to get over.
Right.
But, yeah.
And it sounds like you change a lot, your palate in tastes and cooking styles throughout this book. You mentioned that it's an interracial marriage.
Yeah.
Your husband, well, you're, first of all, you're Italian.
I'm Italian, okay. Yeah. My dad was born in Italy, and all four of my grandparents are from the same village in southern Italy. The foods my mom knew how to cook basically were the same things my dad had grown up eating because their mm-hmm. mothers were schoolgirls together in Italy. So I came from that, and the richest parents are from China, and his mom's a fantastic cook. But it was all, you know, lighter dishes, several dishes, uh-huh. you know, but different tastes.
There's a lot of similarities in technique, at least, between yeah. cooking Italian and Chinese. Quickly cooked, there's a lot of noodles.
Yeah, it's true. Even things like we eat frittata a lot, which, you know, is sort of, there's Italian versions of that, and sort of like, I don't know if you'd call it an egg foo young or something, but definitely egg binding different things together, savory things.
Yeah, eggs not just for breakfast, eggs and whatever.
Yeah.
It's funny because I'm half Chinese, and one of the first foods my mom really liked was Italian food because spaghetti, and it was just it was a lot more intuitive. Like, you stir fry vegetables with garlic, just in both cultures. That's mm-hmm, a mm-hmm. simple preparation, and things are things tend to be quickly cooked, I think.
Yeah, and very. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, good Italian food is, you know,
fresh ingredients,
very fresh. Yeah, little done to it.
So
even things like risotto, and I mean, Rich calls it rice gruel, but
rice gruel,
like congee or something like this, you know, with rice dishes. Maybe
tries to make parallel. That leap.
I'm not totally sold, but
all right. So actually, yeah. If you guys have any questions, I'm talking to the listeners today. You can call in. The number to call is 718-497-2128. We're going to take a musical break. And we'll be back in a second.
Marry me, John. Marry me, John. I'll be so good to you. You won't realize I'm gone. Marry me, John. Marry me, John. I'll be so sweet to you. You won't realize I'm gone. Into at will, and will you guess when I come around next? I hope your open sign is blinking still. So marry me, John. Marry me, John. I'll be so good to you.
Hey, you're listening to Cheap Date. This is Kathy Arway, your host again. And we just listened to St. Vincent. That was Marry Me, John. That's because we're talking with Michelle Maestro, the author of The Gastronomy of Marriage. Sorry, Maestro.
Maestro.
Sorry. And so anyway, this is Heritage Radio Network brought to you by TechServe. Actually, you can call in if you have any questions. The number is 718-497-2128. We're also here with Matt Bagdanoff. And we're just talking about dating, and cooking together, some huevos mm-hmm. rancheros talk just mm-hmm. now. I want to get back to your book, Michelle. So because one of the things, like you were saying, it kind of food just intersects all your interests, mm-hmm. and you know, your marriage, of course. But this book is about so much more than just food. But you do get a lot of specific, you know, recipes in here,
right.
And they're all very diverse because there's some like from Rich's heritage, and it's just a really beautiful. And I love this the shopping too. I mean, maybe I'm such a dork. I just really like shopping for food.
Me too.
But your descriptions of going to the green market and then finding some. I don't know. It was like you described the Brussels sprouts on the
stalk.
On the stalk, as you know, really eye-catching and appealing.
Oh.
So that's really fun. And so, what else do you do? So you wrote this book. What are you working on now?
So I wrote that book. I'm working on a blog that's called themarketreport.net, and basically it's 45 green markets in New York. And I feel like we only ever see our own. I thought it'd be cool to visit other ones.
So oh, I know this blog. How did I just figure that out?
And basically just talking about what's seasonal, what's out there, and talking to the different farmers
totally.
And things like that.
Do you have like podcasts of the farmers on the blog?
No, but that's a good idea. Okay. I've just been sort of getting my feet wet with
yeah,
it, but
sure.
I'd love to do more profiles with the, I mean, right now I just really chat with people as I'm buying stuff, but I would love to do
deeper
profiles with them. And yeah, I think people really want to put a face to what they're buying. And mm-hmm. we're in this time of more accountability with your food. I think people like knowing the source. So that's been interesting to me. And really, I just love, you know, I'm already missing the plums from summer, you know, like going every week and seeing, mm-hmm. you know, what there is new, what's gone, and you know, realizing how fleeting it all is and enjoying it when it's in season versus feeling like we can eat strawberries year round, which, you know, they're crummy year round and they're so exciting in June.
Well, they're only around green markets in June as far as I'm concerned, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you want to go the, you know, down the street to the conventional store and get these oversized, like,
balloons
that are white
and,
yeah, they're totally different.
Yeah.
So do you like to scour different green markets in the city, or do you go to like Union Square? Which one's
closest? Well, my main one is Grand Army Plaza.
Me too.
I love it. but no, I go to Union Square, and for the blog, I've just been visiting all these ones I'd never been to, which has been fun.
Really? What's a good one that I need to check out?
I like Zuccotti Park down by like Ground Zero. I'd never been there before, which is kind of a neat... you know, it's like business people buying one apple and then people who live nearby, you know, stocking up. Yeah, so different crowds
are totally
different. The Fort Greene one is a really nice, long, snaking one that goes along the side of the park in Fort Greene.
That's a good, concise green market. Yeah.
And the woman who sells at the New York Beef Company at Union Square told me to go to the one in Inwood on a nice Saturday. That
awesome.
I guess that's right on the water and it's beautiful, so... I keep.
That is fun.
I need to get up there.
Well, I can't wait to read all about your adventures.
Thanks,
marketreport.com?
TheMarketReport.net.
.net.
Yeah, so.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and that's a way that our eating has changed a little since the book. We definitely try to be more seasonal, looking out for, like, genetically modified foods, trying to stay away from that kind of stuff. And
right on.
I think it just is the compromise, too, that we finally found sort of a small repertoire of things that we can make without too much argument or going back and forth.
That sounds good. Because I'm sure you're pretty busy. So what are some of these things?
Usually things that you can put meat in or leave out of. It's good to have a handful of those.
Are you still a vegetarian?
You know, I do eat a little meat now since the book. For our honeymoon, we went to Argentina, and I felt like that's such a big meat culture. I should be missing out. And it was right there, and it's local. And so now maybe, you know, once or twice a month I eat.
Grilled in front of your face, right?
Yeah. If it's like local
pitchfork.
And yeah. Really, you drive out of town and they're all the cows are like standing right there on the pampa. So
happy cows. And you're like, okay,
yeah,
I can do this.
So it's like local, grass-fed, you know, hormones. Then I feel okay about eating it. So yeah, but like pastas, risottos, frittatas, we eat a lot of. Sometimes even just having a big salad and then sort of eating, you know, like sort of tapas style with like some chopped up boiled eggs and whatever different vegetables are in the house and some cheeses and olives and good bread.
Oh, it sounds like you eat pretty well.
But that's like such a simple thing to do. That's sort of just like clearing out the fridge kind of meal. I've sort of converted Rich to salads. He's never... Chinese people apparently don't eat salad. Maybe you know this also.
Right.
Or cold things.
Yeah. I had some friends from Taiwan visit me for a while, and they were like, why do people eat lettuce? And they were like, everyone thought it was strange because we fry lettuce. I was like, what are you talking about? So they stir fry lettuce, like romaine, whenever they see it. They're like, why would you eat that raw? it's all bizarre. But yeah, salads.
I thought Rich was exaggerating when he told me this. And then he actually had an uncle come from China, and he got off the plane, and it was this huge journey. And we're like, are you starving? Did you eat on the plane? He said, no, I didn't eat anything. They only served us salad. Huge flight, and he still wouldn't dare touch the salad.
So what is something that Rich may have lent to your palate?
I definitely am a decent fried rice maker now because of Rich.
Can't go wrong. It's always a good...
And steaming a whole fish, I never would have attempted that before, but that's a really easy thing to do. Like, just stick in, like, ginger and garlic and some herbs in there and cook the whole thing.
That's what I love to do with fish, too.
It's so good. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people, I think, are a little bit puzzled about what to do with fish, and I try to recommend that.
The head freaks them out, I think, at first. I think that's what takes a little getting used to.
Okay, but, what do you think, Matt? Do you like whole fish with the head and its tail?
No, I'm the kind of guy... It's not that it's that difficult. I just don't have any cookware that would support a whole fish like that.
Small sardine.
I usually do... I like cooking up tuna steak.
Mm.
Really rare.
Okay.
Super pink on the inside. It was just, you know, nothing. Garlic, maybe. Or a little bit of citrus.
So I like to ask folks, what is their like favorite romantic meal to make, or what is your ideal dish that, or was there a dish that kind of like our meal together that like really sealed the deal for you and Rich, or for you and Lisa?
Well, I read about it in the book the first time we had our first date. We were friends for a long, long time, and then suddenly I think something clicked. Some tequila helped that, but then suddenly something clicked. So then we went on our first date, and at the beginning of the meal, he ordered a souffle, and there was an asterisk on the bottom of the menu saying, you know, you had to order it in advance. And so that he was the kind of person who recognized that and ordered it. For some reason, this really, I realized, you know, we were on the same page as eaters, and I really respected that. And
so because he took it really seriously.
He took it seriously, yeah. It wasn't...
Wanted to... Yeah.
Something he really realized good. This was going to be very good, and we should get this. Not that he, you know, was going to even turn down dessert at the end.
Okay.
But, we're also, as unromantic as it sounds, you know, for, like, New Year's, sometimes we'll get lobster or, you know, Rich makes a mean linguine and clam sauce. So I think, shellfish is, I don't know, something we both really like.
It seems luxurious, definitely.
Yeah, I think so.
But also comforting at the same time. A big plate of pasta is not something, you know, to get too fussy about.
No.
I think you slurp it up, like, you know.
It's so good, and with good bread, and yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Ideal meal for you, Matt? Or pasta, too. I know you're into making pasta.
Yeah, well, moreover, Lisa is into, and she wants to perfect her art and start her own little pasta business. So I bought her one of the little Atlas pasta rollers and cutters.
Did you see this new book that came out with all the pasta shapes?
What is it called?
It came out last week. I'm forgetting the name, but the Atlas made me think of it. But it's some little old lady in Italy, and even, you know, she does the coins and the witch hats.
Yeah. I read about that in the Times.
Yeah.
She saw that article. Gosh. She showed it to me, and she has a couple of books. One's like the Bible of Pasta, and the other one is the Encyclopedia or something, some
that
other sort
sense.
Of
pasta is huge, huh?
Yeah, and you know, she learned her tricks out in Italy. Actually, she lived there for 4 years.
Oh, nice!
And she did this crazy walk from Bologna to Florence.
Pilgrimage.
Exactly. Some wacky guy did this little trek by himself and walked through the forest. And he would stop off at these little houses along the way that are run by these old Italian mothers, grandmothers. Man. And basically he was like, share with me some of your authentic dishes, some of the family recipes. And so they would, and then he wrote about them and published this book. And you can go to either Florence or Bologna, and you can follow his path.
Oh, wow.
And
you can go to those.
Now our all the little
you
grannies
were like,
like,
okay, pause to that.
Look it up.
Hey guys, this is Jack.
Hey,
I actually found that first book, The Pasta Shapes. It's called The Encyclopedia of Pasta by Aurora Zanini de Vida.
All right. So, thank you. Sounds good. Thanks.
Get to work on that pilgrimage one, because that's really amazing. But you could go. You can do the same walk and go to the same houses and talk to the same old Italian grandmothers and get cooked a meal. And
they
let you stay for
free. Grannies, like, gave up their info.
Yeah.
They usually keep it close to the chest.
Really? Is that what your grandmother does, Michelle?
My dad's mom, I'm sure she left out, like, one ingredient out of every, recipe she gave.
I don't think...
She was a killer cook.
I don't think... Yeah, I don't think any of the recipes are in there. I think it's just that you go and they make it for you, and that's the experience in itself, is you just experience how authentic it can get.
You know, sometimes good cooking isn't really about transcribing it into literature in that form. Certainly in Chinese cooking, there's no history of, like, recipes. That's just not... It's not a tradition.
Interesting.
It's all just like pick it up, you watch, you cook, you eat it, and then you figure it out.
No, that's a good point, even because my my mother-in-law, she learned, I mean, her mother didn't cook, they had help in the house, which I guess maybe people did, and so she learned she'd be in the kitchen with a family cook and watching him, so it wasn't even like there was a tradition from her mother that was being passed down. She just learned by watching.
Right, and eating, and tasting it, and figuring out which ones you like best.
I'm jealous of this pasta making, though. I've never tried my hand at it. I think...
You have no idea how amazing fresh pasta is when it's made, like, 10 minutes before.
I think one of my seminal food memories is my grandmother's ravioli that would just melt in the mouth. And we'd take these long car rides every Sunday out to Brooklyn. She lived in Bensonhurst. And, you know, as a little kid, it just felt like forever. And it was totally worth it for these ravioli. So I think that'd be the greatest thing to be able
to make. Can you make that, Michelle?
No, I've never tried making handmade pasta. She was incredible. Does your girlfriend make ravioli? Can I come over?
I'm going to work on, this is the part of the business, I'm going to work on the ravioli and the tortellini fillings.
Yeah.
And then she rolls out the pasta. So, yeah, we should have a big old dinner party.
All right.
That sounds fantastic.
Drop off some business cards and... I wish I had something to plug for her, but still in the preliminary stages.
Cool. Well, it looks like pasta is definitely one of the winning dishes so far in terms of people just loving, you know, to cook together, eat together with somebody special.
Yeah.
I don't know why. We'll see, I guess.
Well, so much about cooking is caring for people, right? That you feel loved. Even with the cleaning up, I think I feel very loved when somebody does that.
Mm-hmm.
But cooking is like, I think that's why it was such an also... natural fit for marriage, because it is a way that we show love.
Yeah,
I think,
and pasta is so cheap and simple. I mean, when you know, it varies what you put in it, but pasta is typically pretty. Yeah.
No, we do it like
beginner food.
If you have a handful of good olives and then the like drained canned tuna and some chili flakes, you can make like a puttanesca that's so good and so quick and cheap.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Michelle and Matt.
So fun to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. So check out The Gastronomy of Marriage. There's so much more to it that we didn't get into today. But thanks again. And thanks so much for Jack Inslee, our engineer today, and everybody at Heritage Radio Network, TechServe. And I'm Kathy Arway, Cheap Date. Come back tomorrow at Monday, 1 p.m. See ya. Don't want